You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 27th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Is Afghanistan once again becoming a sanctuary for terrorists? Would you walk off the job over inferior olive oil? And does moonshine taste quite the same when you're actually allowed to make it? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Kate Clark and Vincent McAvenny will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll have live music from John R. Miller. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Kate Clark, former BBC correspondent in Kabul, currently co-director of the Afghanistan Analysts Network, and by Vincent McAvenny, reporter and regular Monocle commentator. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Hi.
Kate, first of all, welcome to the Monocle Daily. It is your first time here.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
And as is customary, I mean, the inevitable hazing practical jokes will manifest themselves throughout the show. Just don't look up. But we do ask guests who are here for the first time to introduce and or explain themselves to our listeners. Who are you and how did you get here?
Well, I guess my main interest is Afghanistan, mm-hmm. but I've also worked in the Middle East and I've worked on news programs in Britain as well, covering domestic radio. Afghanistan, I was there. I was the only Western correspondent there in the late 90s, the last few years of the last Taliban mm-hmm. regime. I was there both when Kabul fell in 2001 and 2021.
That's got to be a fairly rare double, having seen both falls of Kabul.
Yeah.
Or at least both the 21st century falls of Kabul. There have been many previous.
Yeah. And will there be another?
Well, we will be returning to the subject of Afghanistan. Vincent, you cunningly foreshadowed a few weeks ago that you were going skiing.
Yes.
You have now been skiing.
That's right. I was skiing last week in the Alps. It was a very warm, very sunny week, and it was clear.
That sounds non-ideal.
Non-ideal. And it was very clear just from the first glimpse I got of the mountain driving through the Alps that things were not as they once were. The mountains were essentially freckled. The brown patches and the trees had no snow, and the runs were highly maintained and groomed to keep the snow that they had earlier in the season. And what was really interesting was it's very clear that this is now a whole sector in France, a whole region that knows it's under threat, because there is a very active environmental campaign plastered on all of the kind of poles of the lifts and everything else about what they're trying to do to keep the economy going and keep the sort of protections needed to keep the mountains skiable. But you do wonder, particularly when we got to sort of the lower parts of the resorts, it was just slush and mud, how much longer Europeans are going to be able to go to the Alps to ski.
Well, that all sounds thoroughly depressing. But we're going to start with something even more depressing than that, which is Afghanistan, which has this week found itself yanked back into the headlines by association with last Friday's terrorist attacks in Moscow. Though the suspects are apparently citizens of Tajikistan, they have been claimed by ISIS-K, the franchise of Islamic State, which operates at least partially out of eastern Afghanistan. One concern raised in certain quarters following the West's abandonment of Afghanistan to the Taliban in 2021 was the possibility that Afghanistan might once again become a playground for terrorist groups with global ambitions. This was, after all, exactly what happened the first time. Kate, we defer obviously to your vastly superior Afghanistan expertise measured against literally everybody else at this table. Is it too much of a reach to draw a line from the abandonment of Afghanistan a couple of summers ago to what happened in Moscow last Friday?
Yes. Yes. in the even before 2021, when the old republic fell and all US, UK forces, everyone else left, the Taliban and the US military and the Afghan government had been on the same side fighting Islamic State, Khorasan province, which is like it's like the local franchise. It's not like an arm of Islamic State from Syria and Iraq. And they pretty well wiped it out. It did hold quite a lot of territory in the east, but together these three forces wiped it out. And since taking power, the Taliban have been really brutally suppressing ISK. They're from a different bit of Islam than the Taliban. They've got a different school of Islam, which is not necessarily a problem, but they are competitors for the most radical voices in Afghanistan. And they are the enemy of the Taliban. I would say as well, in Afghanistan, they're not that much interested in foreigners. They're more interested in killing Shia Muslims. So there's been a series of deadly, horrible attacks that have carried on. We had 2020, we had an attack on a maternity hospital mm-hmm. with mainly Shia Muslim women. More recently, we've had attacks in a Shia majority neighborhood of Kabul, but also a bank in Kandahar, a hotel hosting Chinese engineers. This group is, it's not just Afghanistan, also Pakistan. Mm-hmm. It operates in, and it always has done. And it's always been very much domestically focused. If it is going after targets quite a long way away in Russia, that would be very, very novel.
Vincent, it's an awful thought. But what does happen if this does keep happening? If Islamic State, I guess, end up performing a role under Taliban 2.0, somewhat analogous to the role Al-Qaeda played under Taliban 1.0, i.e. they take advantage of the power vacuum in Afghanistan to set up as a base and operate out of there. Nobody, not the West, not Russia, wants to go back to Afghanistan because everybody has now learnt that one the hard way. But does a momentum towards that start to grow if this sort of thing keeps happening?
Well, that's the fear for the last few years, ever since the withdrawal, that a group would move in and, as you say, copy the Al-Qaeda model, set it up as a headquarter and project around the world from there. It's interesting, earlier this week when France announced that it was raising its threat level to the highest level, mm-hmm. which is pretty understandable because they've got an Olympics coming. That is a big event. They've been attacked before. The same things happened in London back in 2012 where the threat level was escalated. But what was interesting in the announcement as well is that President Macron confirmed that he said several IS attacks had been thwarted in France in recent months. And they had also picked up on the chatter that the Americans had picked up on and even warned Russia that they thought that ISK was plotting something. So there is now this theory, of course, that something more could happen. We have had a sort of quietening down in the past few years of big sort of spectacle attacks in Europe after a wave of them in the late sort of 2010s. But I think that the escalation in France of the threat level shows that they very much think that there could be something on the cards. But what do we do? I mean, as you say, there is absolutely zero interest in any NATO members in the UK, in the US, in putting troops back in the ground or doing any kind of missions into Afghanistan. Whether or not they could potentially start doing drone exercises or not, I think maybe they're just waiting to see how Russia reacts to this, whether or not they go on a bombing campaign potentially in Afghanistan. But this was the fear ever since the withdrawal in 2021.
To go back to that withdrawal, Kate, there was, I mean, I think at the time, a certain amount of willfully deluded optimism about the idea of Taliban 2.0. It can't possibly be as bad as it was last time. Afghans have had 20 years of relative freedom. They do understand that there is a wider world out there in a way that they didn't previously. But we have had this week just a statement from the Taliban's nominal leader. He doesn't get out much, Hibatullah Akhundzada, endorsing wholeheartedly the institution of stoning of women as a punishment for adultery. Can we safely conclude at this point that you wouldn't live long on the difference between this Taliban and the previous Taliban?
Well, I mean, there is no power vacuum in Afghanistan. I should correct you. The Taliban are in charge. They've got full territorial control. And they're authoritarian, so they don't really have the resources to run a really efficient police state, but that's sort of where that's what they'd like to do. And they are there, they feel, by the grace of God. They've beaten two superpowers because they were part of the Mujahideen that defeated the Soviet Union, and now America. So, you know, and Hibatullah, who's their supreme leader, and he is a real leader. Everyone obeys him in the Taliban. He thinks that he's God's... I mean, he says he's God's agent on earth, and we, the West, are the party of Satan. So they have a particular line on Islam. And, you know, most Muslims around the world would not really recognise the religion as their own. And indeed, you know, Islamic scholars go to Kabul and say, look, are you, you know, why are you doing this? It's not really part of the religion. And they say, look, you don't do religion properly. You don't do Islam properly. We do Islam properly. We are full-hearted, absolutely bound. And he uses words like jihad.
Mm.
So he says the jihad isn't over. The jihad against the Westerners was one thing. We now have a jihad to create an absolutely pure Islamic state. So that's where we are. And, you know, you're perfectly right. Westerners aren't going to go back there. If change comes now, it will be from within. It will be Afghans doing it. But it's hard.
Oh, doubtless. And just finally on this, that was one thing I did want to ask about, because my own experiences of Afghanistan in the late 90s were extremely brief. I was just there for a couple of weeks. But it was anything I told the people I interacted with, who were obviously all male, but nonetheless, anything I told them about just the everyday details of my own life in London, and I'm sure you found the same, I think they felt like they were addressing a Martian. Nothing I said made any sense to them. I don't think they believed the half of it. They had no frame of reference for any of this. There was no television. There was almost no radio. There were no books. There was no comprehension of the outside world at all. Afghanistan now, obviously, a lot of Afghans do have that understanding of the outside world. They've had 20 years of relative freedom. They've had access to the online realm. They've had access to foreign media. Some have been able to travel. Do you get the impression that the Taliban will be able to put all that back in the box in the long term?
But the Taliban themselves have changed, and this is the interesting thing. You talk to young... We talked to Taliban, my organisation, which we do research and we write, Afghanistan Analyst Network. I mean, there's Taliban with girls in school. You think in the 90s they banned all girls' education. Mm-hmm. There are senior Talibans who've put their daughters through university. So that's the refugee experience that they've had in Pakistani cities or the Gulf. They see that education isn't a disaster.
They don't seem all that keen.
But you've got this clique in charge who were the most conservative, the most rural. I mean, Afghans would, many would say, the most backward people in charge. And you have many Taliban who think that girls should go to school and university, but they're not in charge and they obey the leader. And they may think that, but they haven't crossed the line. They've talked about it, but they haven't really pushed against the leadership's desire to keep secondary age girls out of school and girls out of university. But there is a huge desire for both of those in Afghanistan. So it's pushing against the tide, I think.
Well, we will stick with the theme of Afghanistan, because the UK's Veterans Affairs Minister, rather, Johnny Mercer, has been given 10 days by a judge to reveal his sources of allegations that British troops committed war crimes in Afghanistan on pain of a potential prison sentence. Mercer, himself a former British Army officer who served three tours of Afghanistan, suggested to a public inquiry last month that he had information confirming that members of the UK's elite Special Air Service regiment had murdered Afghan civilians. Vincent, Mercer has been on quite a journey, hasn't he, from ardent defender of the British military and Afghan war crimes sceptic to very much believer.
Johnny Mercer is quite an interesting Conservative MP. His political career, I think, is best described as erratic. he's ran into problems at different turns, and in part that's been because he's sort of effectively shot his mouth off a lot, and his career has been somewhat stymied sometimes because he tends to not think too hard sometimes before he does speak.
Now, he is one of those people who just should have stayed off social media.
Yeah, quite possibly. And reality TV as well. He was another one that went down that path. But, you know, in his action as Veteran Affairs Minister, he has been trying to sort of boost the sort of profile of the needs of veterans in this country. And he has tried to play within the system a bit more than he'd done in previous roles, because it is close to his heart. He is an ex-serviceman. But it is very interesting that, you know, he's taken this position now that he says that he has been told that this behaviour was going on, but is refusing to speak about this. Now, the leader of the inquiry, Sir Charles Haddon Cave, the quote that he said was that Mr. Mercer needs to decide if he's serving the public interest and the national interest in getting to the truth of these allegations, and criticised Mr. Mercer for a misguided understanding of the term integrity and an inappropriate sense of loyalty. That is a pretty strong rebuke. And whether or not Johnny Mercer decides, you know, because he will ultimately decide to keep this information to himself and potentially go to prison, it is going to potentially be the kind of end of a political career that has, as I said, been erratic. But I think he feels, from what he says and the passion he speaks about the brothers in arms that he had, that it would be the right thing to do, even if it is effectively going to end his political career.
Kate, is there a wood versus trees issue here? Is the anonymity or identity of the whistleblowers the actual point? Is the point not the crimes that may have been committed by British troops? And it's not like Johnny Mercer's sources are the only sources for this. It is now quite well documented that there were concerns from quite a long way back about the behaviour of the SAS in particular.
Well, there's a public inquiry.
Well, indeed.
Yeah. I mean, I think as someone who worked in journalism for many years, your sources are sacrosanct. And the idea that you could be forced to reveal them, I find really shocking. I think the other thing, to military people, they really dislike their comrades committing war crimes. If you're from an army that actually feels that it has honour on its side and it's fought a good fight, if you've got people who are killing civilians, which is the really serious allegation here, it's not a... I mean, at worst, everyone closes ranks, but at best, if you're an honourable soldier, you don't want those people escaping justice. And I, you know, from dealing with military people who've worked in Afghanistan, there's a huge affection still. I mean, it might sound strange for listeners who think that the British and the American and the other armies were the enemies of Afghans, but they were fighting shoulder to shoulder with Afghan soldiers.
Indeed, so.
And I'm amazed. I mean, everyone has gone through Afghanistan. Most people bring away an affection for Afghans. But for the military, there's this, they were their comrades and they feel they abandoned them. So there's a guilt. There's also people like Johnny Mercer, others, they've worked really hard to try and get their old comrades who they think are in danger out of the country. And the other allegation here is that there has been a veto on getting those soldiers out who are in danger, who are in the special forces, working closely with British forces, because they might give evidence against British special forces who allegedly committed war crimes. So that's the other twist in this tale.
Vincent, there is something on the face of it quite honourable about what Mercer is doing here and the means that the risks he's willing to undertake to protect his sources. Is he, though, and you mentioned his somewhat erratic persona, is he doing a decent enough job, do you think, of communicating what he's doing and why he's doing it?
I don't think he is, because it is right that he is protecting his sources, but I think he needs to very much explain it better to the public. He is someone who can be quite glib in how he communicates. And I think, you know, if this is the hill that he is going to die on in terms of his political career, he could explain this better to the public, and he could talk about the points that you've just mentioned, you know, the loyalty within ranks, the fact that this is something that they themselves don't like because it brings the reputation of the whole army down. And if he did go on that, it would be interesting. I mean, he hasn't done if he did a big set piece interview on this, I think he could win people around to his cause. But as it stands at the moment, the British public, when you mention Afghanistan, they aren't really that interested.
No.
They don't want to talk about it. And also, when you talk to soldiers, I have as well, who have been in Afghanistan, a lot of them have suffered increased levels of PTSD since the UK's withdrawal, because many of them who had put to bed a lot of the issues that they had, it all opened up again, and a lot of them feel that a lot of the losses that they suffered were for nothing because of what happened. And so many of those people are also struggling once again and possibly don't want to speak out, you know, in aid of Johnny Mercer as well, don't want to engage with it because it is just such a sort of open wound once again.
Well, we will doubtless follow Johnny Mercer's story as it proceeds over coming days, but we will move along to issues nearer to home, and it is perhaps not the most significant unintended consequence of the UK's departure from the EU, but the fact of Brexit has deprived Brexiteers of one of their animating joys, i.e. stories in which Europe's institutions ascend to self-parodic heights of Europeanness. A certain eventually grievously overpromoted Telegraph columnist would have made exuberant hay with this week's ructions at the European Central Bank in Frankfurt, where staff, led perhaps unsurprisingly by the Italian contingent, have mutinied over lesser olive oil being served with their lunchtime salads. Vincent, we will move along to a couple of more pressing strikes shortly, but in terms of the olive oil rebellion, where do your sympathies lie?
I mean, as you say, Boris Johnson would have made hay of this one. It is another sort of bendy bananas, you know.
I think it's glorious. I approve wholeheartedly.
What is interesting, I mean, having worked at a European-based news company, this was in France, and going to their offices was a fascinating experience in the lunchtime culture because, you know, I attempted to eat a sandwich at my desk and was robustly told,
oh my
you
God.
Must not do this, come to the canteen. And, you know,
the canteen was offering for 3 hours.
Yeah,
drink two bottles
quite,
of wine.
Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah, that was one of the big things. Alcohol was freely available and being drank at all levels of the company. And the food was definitely of a higher standard than you get in British canteens. So I think it is, you know, it's not helping its reputation, perhaps externally to the EU and how institutions are run that this has occurred. But I think across the continent, many people will potentially agree with what
but
the staff
you
have
feel
done.
The same. I would feel the same if they gave me margarine instead of butter, or tea
yeah.
granules instead of proper tea. I mean, I can see.
Yeah, or having, like non-HP ketchup is
having,
a, is
having
a,
shared
be
a flat
one.
With an Italian. I can feel where they're coming from.
This is something they do take gloriously seriously as a people. We do unfortunately have to move on to altogether more tedious strikes, some of which are looming here, tube strikes and train strikes in the UK. In terms of rail strikes here in the United Kingdom, the how are we going to tell jokes kind of right themselves. But do you, Kate, generally sympathise when, I mean, there's always a balance between sympathy with the strikers versus irritation with your own inconvenience, and obviously your own inconvenience is the point of the strike.
I mean, the rail service in Britain is generally so bad.
Mm.
And I think the strikes are a sort of minor part of that, I would say. And actually, I mean, I've just been down to Devon, which is in the southwest of England.
By train?
Yeah.
That was brave.
I dropped my phone on the track and had to get a later train that I wasn't booked on that was actually more expensive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every single person was helpful who worked for this train company. This is my experience. The people who work for the companies are brilliant. They're funny. They really sympathise with passengers who are in trouble, usually because of, you know, there aren't enough people on shift or the stock is old or all the other horrible problems with our rail service. Surely it's the system. And the strikes, I think, are a symptom of a really dysfunctional service rather than the main problem.
Speaking of someone who, it took 3 hours for me to get from Gatwick to central London on Saturday, which normally should take about half an hour. I think the UK
that's
is now
almost literally in quicker to walk territory
isn't it? You know, I think we are in a bit of a doom loop in terms of the British model of franchising because people are being told, you know, get back to the office, we need to do this. But then they're hearing that rail networks aren't working, the franchises aren't working, they've cut the timetables down. You can be standing on the platform with a train that's meant to take off in 5 minutes' time, but the company calculates that they haven't sold enough tickets, so it's just being instantly cancelled, which is happening on certain lines at the moment. So those kind of stories are then putting people off from even attempting to travel on the train, which means that passenger numbers are down, which means that the franchise model is collapsing. Many people saying that it's time for that to go. I think we're about to have in the UK Avanti West Coast, which is an Italian company which took over the West Coast line, is on the verge of collapse and being nationalised. That, I think, will be a bit of another landmark moment in the sort of failure of the model that we've had in Britain, where we have these companies who take over these contracts for short periods to run the services, some of them owned by the state governments of other European countries that we subsidise, they extract the profits from and put them into European-based rail networks. It is a crazy system here in the UK. But the interesting thing is, had it been 2018, 2019, I think we'd be more willing to complain about strikes in this country. But as it is, because of the disruption of the pandemic, people now just are trying to get on with it. But there's also a feeling across the country because of how high inflation has been across. If you look at the level, and I think this has come as a real shock to the Conservative government when you talk to Tory MPs, the level of support for strikers between the NHS, between teachers, between the rail workers, it's been so high because people feel that the government isn't running things right and inflation is so high that we all deserve a pay rise.
Just a final thought on this one, and going back to the current experience of the UK rail user, was there much difference in terms of your, I assume, economy class fare to Devon versus what it would cost to fly first class to, I don't know, Los Angeles?
Yes, something like that. Sort of similar. Yeah, yeah. I mean, what to do? And the thing is, we are facing a global climate emergency, as Vinnie has talked about. I mean, you didn't have snow on the Alps. I've just written a piece about Afghanistan where people were worried if they would have drinking water this year. So there are levels of problems.
And
but you know, you've got people with livelihoods likely depending down the drain in France.
And it also,
I'm not minimising that at all. I'm just saying.
Yeah, and that snow melt also affects then how the land beneath the mountains used for agriculture, the water table throughout the year of that, if it's falling as rain in the winter and not kind of holding as snow and then melting, that's going to have a knock-on effect as well. So it is, you know, all connected.
It is an emergency. We had 40 degrees centigrade weather 2 years ago. I mean, one of the obvious things to me is invest in the rail network. Trams, buses.
It would seem relatively obvious.
Relatively obvious, yes.
Well, finally, for today's panel.
Misty taste of moonshine, teardrop in my eye, country road. Take me home to the place.
Song requiring no back announcement. The legislature of West Virginia has decided to undermine an entire subgenre of country songs about the necessity of concealing one's still from the G-men and T-men by allowing citizens to celebrate their Appalachian heritage by manufacturing up to 5 gallons, i.e. nearly 20 litres of moonshine per annum. Moonshine, for those many abstemious listeners who have never sampled it, is homebrewed spirit of exceedingly variable quality, from a pleasant sipping libation of mild intoxicating effect to something difficult to distinguish from lawnmower fuel. Vincent, do you fear that West Virginia is insufficiently braced for the rash of exploding garages?
I think this is going to be a public health emergency very quickly, because when I was told about the story, the first thing I thought of was, doesn't that make you blind? If formulated incorrectly,
temporarily,
it leads
if not
to
permanently, yes.
Yeah, temporarily, if not permanently. But wandering around, you know, sipping this stuff and wandering around in the garage manufacturing plant, probably, you know, losing your vision, not the best idea. It sounds like a disaster. And in a country as well where you have an insurance-based health system, probably not the best idea.
We did want to broaden this discussion out to include our doubtless extensive journalistic experience of being served samples of the local hooch. Kate, is there any that you, and I am speaking from personal experience here, taken 2 sips of and then spent the rest of the evening tipping into your boots?
Yes, but actually probably adulterated rather than homemade. Whiskey in Pakistan. Oof. Always put it in the freezer and then you can at least see if it's alcohol or not.
Okay.
That's my top tip.
Yeah. I'm thinking, Vincent, mostly of the Balkans circa the 1990s and wincing through servings of clearly homemade slivovitz at various checkpoints in Bosnia.
Sounds like a great time.
it really wasn't, because these were situations in which you were interacting with people about whom you could end up thinking, I'm not sure adding alcohol to this interaction is going to make things any less tense than they already are.
Yeah. My only experience with this, I'd say, would be I did a research master's in, which involved a lot of prison research. And at one point, all the hand sanitizer disappeared from the sort of stations.
No.
Because it was starting to be used as a drinking alcohol. I mean, that's desperate, isn't it?
It is desperate. You didn't try the hand sanitizer, whatever it was they made with hand sanitizer?
I did not, no.
Kate, has there been any, finally, we're trying to close on a somewhat upbeat note, any that you would actually recommend?
What, home?
Of the locally produced backyard still here, you must sample this.
I have to say, as a British person, where it is illegal to distill your own alcohol, and why? I'm sure in the old days it was probably tax. The state wanted to tax everything, but secondly, it makes you blind. That's my first. That's what we've all been told.
I mean, the closest I think we've gotten here is slow gin. We've agreed that that's not sort of brewing the alcohol part yourself. It's just brewing an elixir, isn't it?
Yeah.
To all our West Virginia listeners, please, please, please distill carefully. Kate Clark and Vincent McAvaney, thank you both for joining us. Finally, on today's show and keeping it West Virginian, we have live music from John R. Miller, whose splendid new album Heat Comes Down might indeed furnish an apposite soundtrack for a spot of light bootlegging. John came to Midori House on his recent tour in support of Heat Comes Down, and I began by asking John whether this album was yet another addition to the swiftly emerging genre of records composed under lockdown.
It's kind of hard to say that it's that. We didn't record it, and I didn't even really write a lot of the songs until after we had kind of gotten back out, but it definitely started there, and some of the songs came from a place of isolation like I don't think any of us had ever really experienced before. So I think from the start, it kind of, it was sort of informed by that. But I wouldn't say that it's a lockdown record necessarily. I wrote a ton of songs. It took me a while to start writing again after we got sequestered at home, but I ended up writing a ton of songs that sort of got boiled down to this collection.
I mean, for all the anxiety that underpins some of it, it struck me that it is opened and closed by two relatively upbeat songs. Nobody Has to Know Your Mind, the opening track, sort of seems a memo to self of existential reassurance, and the closer, Press On, reminds, and I quote, short time around, long time gone. Was that a deliberate structural decision to try and start and finish on a relatively upbeat note?
Yeah, when the collection of songs was kind of, when I realized what all was going to go on there, it strikes me as kind of a darker record than I had done in the past. And I felt it was really important to kind of bookend it with some positivity and leave it on an optimistic note. I don't know, just for me, if for nobody else, you know.
We will be closing on a song which in itself does sort of explain the story so far. But in terms of the story so far, I was wondering, growing up in West Virginia, did you internalize the sound of West Virginia? Did the country and bluegrass just seem like the obvious thing for you to find yourself playing?
Not when I first started playing guitar. I was listening to, you know, I first started playing when I was about 14, 15, and trying to write songs as a teenager. I was listening to a lot of kind of punk rock and post-hardcore, and didn't really get into that world until I was about 18. And I met some old-time musicians who I ended up playing with in a band with for a number of years, and they kind of taught me about traditional music and the fiddle and banjo stuff that I had no exposure to really prior to that. You know, I knew about bluegrass, but I didn't really know about the distinction. And we ended up playing a lot of old-time music, and I learned fiddle and banjo from them, and that ended up, now it's like just a part of my life, you know. I don't necessarily perform that kind of music, but I do play it a lot with people back home, just sitting in a circle.
Well, before we hear one song off the new album, there was one other song I did want to ask you about, which I think I alluded to the title before, Conspiracies, Cults and UFOs, which I do recommend to our listeners. It's sort of, I guess, it sounds like Bob Dylan by way of Hayes Carl. It's quite a quite a frantic and confused and paranoid song, although it is leavened with a certain sense of humour, I think. Where did that one come from?
I think it kind of came from the state of things, as it were. I don't know. I'm not. It's been a very confusing and paranoid sort of world on the internet that we've been living in for the last number of years now, and I think it's contributed to a lot of misled and false beliefs, and even at its worst, nationalism and racism and. Just, it's a heavy place to be in. So, you know, it seemed like when we kind of got back out after being at home for so long, and I had to stop being on social media for a while when we were at home because I was just, there's a lot of doom. But once we got back out, I got to actually sort of like see the world and how it had changed. And it really scared the shit out of me. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that.
I think that's permissible. Just finally then, as we were discussing earlier, the song you're going to do for us, I think it sounds fairly explicitly autobiographical, but introduce it if you would.
Yeah, Basements was, that's the name of the song, is Basements. And this song was sort of written kind of as almost like a journal entry, trying to make sense of where I'd been and how I ended up here, and without any idea whether we would be able to travel again or play music again. I don't know. I kind of wanted to just have that for myself. It wasn't even supposed to be on the record, but it kind of wound up there and sort of rounded it out, I think.
Well, let's hear it. John Miller, thank you for joining us.
1, 2... We spent all our time in basements, looking for a sound. Occupied a church hall just outside of town. My friend had a twin, and I had some old no-name strat. And our drummer's dad was cool, he let us come over and practice. Pedal boards and power cords, tape deck on the stairs. Gave up talking to the Lord, but the devil heard my prayers. Got a little older, and I moved out into a room with a cutaway guitar, and I was homesick for the moon. So I hired on with a rogue crew, like a hinge without a door. Got an old Econoline, put the pedal to the floor. We were unrepentant trouble, cynical and self-righteous. Black labels in the moonlight underneath the ancient cypress. And they make off with what you sow, but you can't reap what you still owe. Got a little older, dilated in the woods. Fancied myself some philosopher, but I was only ever good at washing dishes at the cafe, playing bass out on the weekends, sleeping till noon every day, never calling back my friends. I couldn't make the cut, but I could make a bad impression. It's only once you've lost enough you get to learn the lesson. And they make off with what you sow, but you can't reap what you still owe. Now I know my handiwork doesn't sound all that correct. Wood's a little warped, resistors out of spec. But you can string up a slab of pine with some 40 watt 110. And I used to be somebody, I just don't remember when. So back down to the basement, my foolish pride in me. I keep it dimed in 2/4 time and I offer up a plea. And they make off with what you sow, but you can't reap what you still owe.
That was John R. Miller live here at Midori House with his song Basements. It's off his new album, Heat Comes Down, which is absolutely unreservedly recommended. That is all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Kate Clark and Vincent McAvaney. The show was produced by Chris Chermack and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.